Well, thanks. So as Colin says, I'm working on a project that uses this old language of the commons as a way of talking about what we now call intellectual property. You know, who should own ideas and inventions and texts and works of art. And I'm particularly interested in trying to think about the appropriate trade-off between private ownership and common ownership. you know, the Constitution lays out a sort of double rule about giving exclusive right to people for their writings and their inventions, but then also has limited times. And one of the puzzles in the last decade has been where the line should be, because, as you may know, people say there's a new enclosure movement in which content industries are pushing that line out. Jack Valenti says the limited term should be eternity minus a day. That's one position. Others say, you know, information wants to be free. I'm in the middle, but where exactly is the middle? Where is the line? So I've been looking at the founding generation, people like Adams and Jefferson and Franklin and Madison and stuff, just try to understand how they would have framed this issue. It gets framed now mostly in terms of property, that ideas are property that you get to own and you have property rights in them and you get money and you want to protect them. So in a way, what I have to say about the founding generation is fairly simple. That's not how they would have framed these questions. They thought of questions about ideas and inventions in terms of both self-governance and the public good. That if you want to have a self-governing nation, you have to have this free flow of information. It's about self-governance and also about advancing knowledge. But I'm going to talk particularly about Franklin today. any of you, what have you read of Franklin's? Does anybody here know Franklin? You know, did a senior paper or anything about Franklin? Nobody knows anything? Has anybody read the autobiography? Really? Only one person? Well, you must go and read all these. So Benjamin Franklin, born 1706, he was his father was a candle maker and a soap maker in Boston. He ran away from his brother, who was a printer. He was indentured to this printer, went to Philadelphia, became a printer, and became a scientist and inventor and a diplomat. Those were his main. But I've been trying to look at Franklin in terms of these questions about ownership of ideas and inventions. And it's complicated to look at these older fellows because the language is different and the situation is so different. So Franklin famously invents a better fireplace called the Franklin stove or the Pennsylvania stove. And in the autobiography, he says they didn't take a patent on it. He believes that we benefit from the inventions of others, and so the future should benefit from our inventions. If you look, I've been looking through his letters and stuff. You can find places where he seems to be in favor of patents. Fellow wants to move to the United States become a printer of calico, and Franklin says if you move, maybe the legislature can give you a 7-year patent and exclusive right to be the calico printer. Similarly, I found one place where he talks about having a copyright in his almanac. I think in general, Franklin was not an ideologue. I think he approached questions like this pretty much on a case basis. So you can find exceptions, but I want to talk about the sort of wider frame in which we might try to figure out how Franklin would have stood if we were asking him today. And the two points of entry I'm going to use to do this is, one is to talk about how he imagined himself as a writer and author, and the second is to talk about his humor. here's a joke I heard this morning. The rabbi goes into the synagogue and he falls down before the altar and he prays. He says, "Lord, I'm nothing. You know, I'm a zero compared to..." And the assistant rabbi comes and he falls down before the altar. He says, "Lord, I'm nothing at all." And the janitor has seen this and he goes before the altar and falls down. He says, "I'm nothing." And the assistant rabbi says to the rabbi, look who thinks he's nothing. This, I'm going to come back to this when I get to... and some things I'm not going to talk about, but if you want to go back to them when I'm done. One is Franklin is born at a period when guilds and craft guilds are losing their power. And part of the way a guild used to be set up was it had secret knowledge. And it was passed on orally from master craftsperson to apprentice and so forth. And this secret knowledge was technically called the mysteries, things you're not supposed to speak about. Mystery knowledge, secret knowledge, is beginning to be publicly exposed. And Franklin's at the beginning of this, so there's a whole issue around that that is of interest to talk about if you're talking about intellectual property. Another theme is around the cumulative and collaborative nature of science. All of Franklin's scientific inventions and innovations, you can look at them and see the degree to which he was part of a community or not, and that's of interest also. And also he had ideas on private property, which we can go into. But to do this in terms of his self-image, I have one little handout. This is an epitaph that he wrote for himself, imagining that he would put this on his gravestone, somebody would put this on his gravestone after he died. And it says, "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be wholly lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more perfect edition, corrected and amended by the author." So this is a little moment of self-imagining, Franklin is. Anybody want to comment on this for me? If you were reading this as a poem in your undergraduate poetry class. What can we say about how he imagines himself? Do I have to call it cold calling?
It's a lost poem.
Yeah, right. Yes.
He seems to be pushing the idea that when he's gone, people will take up what he has been working on, and all, it's kind of like the like a wiki, for example.
Franklin the wiki, yes.
Well, someone's pulled up a wiki for Ben Franklin. You know, he's like, I'll start it, and then you know, he knows that he has a finite knowledge of everything, and then 50 years from now, that will change, and he will continue to grow and evolve, so to speak, and hopefully he hopes that that will change.
Yeah, that's very. Thank you for that. There's a sense of ongoing revision here. So, and knowledge is. I mean, it's a little more pointed actually. Who is the author at the end and the next end of the?
God.
Yeah. So you could imagine it's God. That God has given us life. We live these imperfect lives. Then you're reborn in heaven, and God resurrects you in your perfected form. But
although not your perfect form, right? A new and more perfect edition.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, that's more the wiki model that there's, and there is this sort of a puzzle in the Franklin stuff of whether when you correct a book, there is whether he's imagining that finally there's a true book, or whether knowledge is constantly revised, and there's never a true book. And so, yes, it doesn't say a new and perfect edition. It's sort of I mean, clearly, he's imagining himself as a book. That's one simple thing to say. But also, it's a book that can be revised. So it's not like a fixed text. One other detail about this, he writes this when he's 22 years old. And it's when he's beginning to be set up as a printer in Philadelphia. He takes his first partnership. So in a funny way, it's not an epitaph. It's a kind of business card. That is, it's a self-imagining about what it is to be a printer. And he used to leave these when he was a guest in somebody's house. He would write this out on a sheet of paper and leave it as a little house gift. So in that sense, it's... You could say, well, here lies the body. Well, what is the here? You think it's the grave. Well, it could be the sheet of paper. That is, if you're a printer and you embody yourself, you know, he's a man of letters, not a man of letters. He's a man of letters. he's the... So in a sense, this is a representative of Franklin himself, that the writing is a part of yourself made exterior. The worms could be bookworms. All right, we'll stop this mad overreading that people in English departments do. But anyway, in this book called his autobiography, he writes it over many years. It's never published in his lifetime. And he first writes it for his son. And on the very first page, he says, if I had my life to live over, I would live it again. This has been a great life. He said, and I would ask only the advantage the authors have in a second edition to correct the faults of the first. And so he presents his life as having what he calls errata. This is the technical term when in book printing. At the end, you sometimes have a list of errata. So in a book, you would have errors. In a life, you have errors. You know, he went to London and didn't write to his girlfriend for a year and a half. He thinks that's an error, mm-hmm. and he would correct it by writing her more often. He has a list of five or six errata. And again, the image is of a book that can be corrected. Another nice place you see this, you may know this, Franklin had this program for self-improvement where he made a list of virtues. He wants to be temperate, he wants to be chaste, he wants to be honest and so forth and punctual and all this. And he used to keep a little notebook of how he was doing on this. Every day he would check, you know, have I been temperate enough? And he says he got tired of writing this down and erasing it and all this. And so he makes himself a book out of leaves of ivory, actual ivory, on which he marks indelibly with a red pen a certain grid. And then he keeps a record of his faults with a pencil. And he says, and then every time he's done with a week, he takes a wet cloth and erases it. It starts over again. So if Franklin, so the argument here is part of Franklin's self-imagining as a printer is that he is like a book. But it's a particular kind of book. It's a book that can be revised. Bernard Cohen, who used to be the philosopher of science here, says that he thinks the thing Franklin liked best about the Constitution was that it could be amended. So you have a text which can be amended. So in that sense, Franklin's self-image is not actually of a book. It's more like a print shop with movable type. That is, in a print shop, you could produce any book, and you could reproduce a book that you had produced. And it is sort of a wiki. I like this a lot. His self-image is that he didn't have the term, but he was struggling for this term. But if he'd been alive today, he would have said, I am like a wiki. Or the other way, a related way, so the print shop with movable type, he once printed a thing called an apology for printers, which was sort of an explanation of why printers print things that some people object to. And it's an argument for, it says, many men have many minds, and if you ask the printer to take a side on this, you're just not going to get a lot printed, or it's going to be sectarian press. That the printer's job is not to take sides and things, it's just to print stuff. And so this is the image of a common carrier, a term that gets used around telephone lines or stuff like this. But in Franklin, you can see the sort of common carrier ethic in terms of printing. It's about net neutrality. you know, the thing should be set up to carry a great diversity of information. And he argues in this way about printing, about the postal service. He was a postmaster in Philadelphia. About newspapers, that they should carry a diversity of opinion. Or another example, in Philadelphia, in the 1730s, there was a revivalist preacher named Whitefield came from England, and the local ministers, first they let him use their pulpits, but then he was too much of a rabble-rouser, they kicked him out, and he had to preach in the fields. And Franklin was upset by this, and he and some friends got together and raised some money, and they built a meeting house for public speakers. And he says, for the use of any preacher in any religious persuasion, the design and building not being to accommodate any particular sect, but the inhabitants in general, so that even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send a missionary to preach Mohammedanism to us, he would find a pulpit in his service. This is Franklin stretching. What is the weirdest thing I can imagine? It's learning about Islam. But nonetheless, he does imagine it. And so, in both of these cases, so I've got two images here of the kind of Franklin self-imagining as a creator and as a printer is not simply a book, but a revisable book or a print shop with movable type, or as a common carrier. And in both cases, there is behind it a kind of model of what the truth is and how you get at the truth. And the model is that individuals are not very good at doing it, that individuals are subject to error. And at that time, there was a sort of, you know, an elevation of reason as a faculty of the human soul, which is to be valued, and the passions as a problem in the human soul. And the individual is imagined to be swayed by appearances and self-interest and so forth, as are sects. And so individuals strive to get to the truth, but they're going to fail. And they're going to make mistakes. And so therefore, what you do is open it up to the public. And there is some belief that if you have public knowledge, this is a way of beginning to winnow out error. There are two ways to restate this idea about the truth. One is there was at the time a kind of ethic of what's called civic republicanism. So America is imagined to be a republic, a place that the government belongs to the people. But the civic republican ideal is that as individual citizens in this country, you suppress personal interest in favor of the public good. This, by the way, gets overturned in the 19th century, and we have what we have today, a sense that if you follow your own self-interest, the public good would somehow automatically follow from it. But in the 18th century, people like Franklin, the suppression of self-interest is a virtue, and it has to do partly with this sense of where the truth lies, that to promote your self-interest is more likely to distort the truth than to discover it. So some people writing about Franklin say you see this in how he works, that his rhetorical style and his political style have to do with self-effacement. And in the autobiography, he says he learned early on if he has a point to make, he'll begin by deprecating himself. He'll say, well, it seems to me, or I may be mistaken in this, but here's my idea. And in a way, what it does is to throw it onto you as the audience. You know, here's a guy who's not sort of insisting on his idea. He's offering it as a thought experiment, and now we're supposed to see if the experiment works. Similarly, in public projects, Franklin, he used to present things anonymously a lot. There'd be a proposal for a public hospital or a public library or a public fire department, and he would do it up saying, you know, some gentlemen have asked me to propose the following idea. and so he would not take it as a personal offering. And again, I think the idea is that if the thing is going to work, it should work on its own terms. I was at a conference recently of a fellow who teaches writing in a law school in Cleveland, a case. He said that in the law, there isn't an ethic about owning your own ideas. That when you write a brief, when judges finally issue opinions and declarations, they will often cite from people's briefs without attribution. And this fellow said he knew he had had his most successful brief when the final judgment, the judge's declaration, quoted without attribution exactly from his brief. And the sense, I think, again, is that we're struggling to get to some sort of truth that we can all agree on, and it's not about personal authority. It's not that Lewis Hyde said this or somebody in particular said this. The question is, can the idea stand on its own? And you're in an area of public discourse, not private discourse, that the law belongs to the public, and so people don't own it personally. And there's a similar republican ethic that Franklin embodies. The second place that I think this comes out of is science, You know, beginning really with Newton, Newton's on an interesting cusp because half of Newton's stuff he tried to keep secret, and then some of it he began to publish. And in London, the Royal Society begins in Newton's lifetime, and they start this thing called Philosophical Transactions, which is the first English-language scientific journal. And it begins, you can't have a scientific community until you begin to have scientific publication. And so an ethic of publishing your work so that it can be criticized and revised and accepted by others emerges around Newton. And Franklin is part of this. So that, for example, he and friends do experiments with electricity in the 1740s, and then he sends these to a friend in England, in London, a guy named Collinson. Are we trying to get somebody in here?
Yeah, it's okay. Go on.
But when he sends them, he's covered, and these get published in London as a pamphlet about electrical discoveries made by these Americans, and it makes Franklin's reputation. It becomes a very famous book. That's astounding. Without the hat, we would think that the shirt was just a.
Yeah, it's important. It's important to have the full image.
Anyway, this makes Franklin's reputation as a scientist, that his work on electricity was a true contribution to knowledge. If you try to start your car and you put the jumper cables on the plus and minus correctly, that's Franklin's invention. The polarity of electricity is Franklin's contribution, to call the charge plus or minus. And actually, the idea of a battery is one of Franklin's, the word battery is one of his inventions. But anyway, when he sends this to Collinson, what he says is, this is an imperfect, you know, we've been doing these experiments, and I keep thinking I should maybe keep this around for a couple of years and try to perfect it. But he says it's better to have ideas communicated so that they will occasion more exacting disquisitions, it being more important that knowledge should increase than that your friend should be thought of as an accurate philosopher. So again, it's a sense that you publish knowing that your iteration is going to have errors in it, and that it will be corrected by others. And so there's an ongoing sense of a community that produces knowledge, not an individual. And, you know, the simple point here is that, you know, the idea that emerges later, really, of individual ownership of knowledge is at odds with both of these ethics, the scientific ethic and the Republican ethic. It's at odds with Franklin's sense of how truth emerges, that if you're interested in truth, you publish. And you publish in a sort of self-effacing way. Franklin's most useful invention was the lightning rod, the grounded lightning rod. And he figures out in 1753 how to do this. And he figures out in the summer of 1753, and he immediately publishes it in Poor Richard's Almanac with precise instructions about how to make a lightning rod. So it's exactly like the patent requirement that you describe your invention clearly enough that anybody could make a copy of it, but without patent. And in case after case, everything you look at where Franklin figures out something new and interesting, he publishes it immediately. And so publishing your results, it actually, the word means to make public. So the ethic is not about individualism and ownership, it's about publication. Now I'm going to go on to this humor issue. I've already talked for my 20 minutes, so, but maybe I'll pause. Does anybody have any comments or questions about the river so far that I've...
There were a couple people in Second Life who were talking about how one of them said that there was individual ownership of knowledge did kind of exist before publication, but it was like, I guess in terms of letters between scientists, or like, I missed some of it because it's going by actually really fast in Second Life.
Well, maybe there's a distinction to be made between the honor and reputation and ownership as property. So it's certainly true that even as early as Newton, there's a lot of argument about priority. And people, you know, it's an honor society, not an ownership society. Or the degree that you own something, what you own is your claim to priority, and that does exist. I think one of these guys, Kepler or somebody, figures out about the orbits of the moon on Jupiter, and he wants to claim priority, so he sends the information to competing astronomers in an anagram that only he. And when they get the anagram, they're going to have to admit that once it's decoded, it's going to show them something, but they can't decode it. So it's a very cunning way of establishing his priority without revealing his information. But actually, the philosophical transactions become a way to establish priority and reveal information. So again, we're at an inflection point between secret knowledge and public knowledge. And so I don't know if that's the point about ownership, but it's certainly, yeah, people... And there were also patents in the sense, and copyright, particularly in Europe, as ways of owning ideas. And less so in the colonies. It was not a well-developed system in the colonies, but there was that sense. But you don't find it much in Franklin. Franklin is really about publication without ownership.
Can I ask Franklin's idea that... revealing knowledge as a way of essentially engaging a collective process of moving towards truth is in some tension, actually, with the idea of individual fallibility, because it's not necessarily the case that a larger group of fallible individuals will be better at arriving at the truth than a smaller subset. And so I'm wondering if he has a sort of more worked out methodology or philosophy about how that process actually works.
Well, I think Franklin famously would never argue about his science. When people disputed him, he would not engage in disputes and say, you know, the truth is out there, and you know, if I got it wrong, it should be corrected. If I got it right, it'll survive. But I think it's a sort of invocation of a scientific method, that reproducibility. And so, yes, individuals are fallible, but you begin to have some sense that if every lab in the country reproduces the experiment and it comes out the same, you have some sense that you're beginning to get beyond the fallibility. And so I think that's what he means by experiment, that experiments should produce results, and if the results can be reproduced, they seem to point to the truth. And so you communalize it in order to get reproducibility. I think that's the answer. Right, right. You know, and again, this comes, you know, Newton imagines that stones fall exactly the same way in America as they do in Europe, and then you can try to test that. Like, travel with your rock. All right, well, let me... tell you, Mike, this is the second way of talking about Franklin, which is the... Franklin was a great hoaxer. He printed hoaxes in the newspaper. He invented characters. Some of them were scatological and rude. But it's said that Franklin comes up with the idea of daylight savings. And... so I got to think about this. I tried to find the document where he does this. So it's a hoaxing document. He's in Paris. It's 1780s. And he's been to a meeting, an evening meeting, where somebody's showing off a new oil lamp and gives off wonderful light. And they get into a discussion of whether the increase in light is well related to the amount of oil you use and how much oil goes into making light. So they're into the economies of oil and light production. And he goes home late, you know, it's 2 in the morning, he goes to bed. And he says, then some accidental noise wakes him up at 6 a.m., and he wakes up and he's astounded to find the room is full of light. And he thinks that they have brought many of these oil lamps in. And then he looks around, and that's not the case. What's happened is that the sun has risen. And he says, and not only that, but he discovers that the sun begins to shine as soon as it rises. He says, people in Paris apparently don't know this. Because, you know, people have almanacs, they know when the sun rises. but he thinks he's the only person who's actually made the discovery that when it rises, it shines immediately. And so he then goes on to suggest that people should stop staying up till 2 in the morning. They should go to bed and get up at 6 when the sun rises. You wouldn't have to have these damn lamps. And then he does a big calculation in the middle of this letter. It's a letter like to the Royal Society of Paris. And he says, and you know, here's how many candles you'd save every year and how much oil, whale oil. And then at the end, he has a paragraph where he says, now people are going to say that in the ancient world they knew this, that the sun shines as soon as it rises. They're going to find some book that where they show that the ancients knew this. He says, now, first of all, I'm not sure they did. I think this is my discovery. However, even if they did, the Parisians have forgotten it. They don't know. They've lost this ancient knowledge. So anyway, this is a typical piece of Franklin Falderal. But it got me thinking, this thing at the end about the ancients and the moderns is an old tension in European Enlightenment thought, because people begin to do mathematics and stuff, and then they discover Euclid, and they say, holy cow, you know, these guys knew all this stuff, and it's been lost for hundreds of years. And so there was sort of anxiety about who is the smarter. There used to be smart people, and we're only just rediscovering this. And one of the aphorisms around this, which begins in the 12th century, actually, and then it goes on and on, is in regard moderns in regard to ancients, if we have seen further than the ancients, it is because we are like dwarves standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, some of you probably know this is also a line that Sir Isaac Newton uses. And there's an amusing book by Robert K. Merton which takes Newton's aphorism. Newton is in an argument with a guy named Hooke about the priority on the theory of colors. And Hooke is saying, I figured this out first. And then Newton writes back, and he's simultaneously trying to give Hooke some credit and take credit himself. And at one point he says, if I have seen further, it is because I have been standing on the shoulders of giants. So Newton says this. Now first, he erases the dwarf part of this. The aphorism always had a dwarf in it, standing on the shoulders of giants. But Newton can't bring himself to say, I am like a dwarf. So he's a big guy standing on the shoulders of other big guys. But anyway, there is in this Merton book one line that got me thinking about the humor of this, which is he quotes Winston Churchill talking about a fellow diplomat at one point. And Churchill says, what has he done that he's so modest about it? Not all of you are getting the joke. That is to say, there's a way, it's like the, who's he to say he's nobody? You know, there's a way of congratulating yourself by pretending to modesty. And so, you know, I think, for me at least, it's clear in the Churchill quip. What's he done that he's so modest about it? It's less clear, but now I think that the Newton line actually is a funny line because it manages to combine this self-aggrandizement with self-effacement. There's a sort of poise in the double claim. Hold on here. Anyway, this is a theme throughout Franklin's work. The theme is usually presented as about pride and modesty, or vanity and humility. And the famous moment is in his list of virtues. The last one is humility. And he says, I was never able to really achieve this. You know, I was never able to overcome pride, the most difficult of human passions. He says, you will see it perhaps often in this autobiography, for even if I could have conceived that I had completely overcome it, I should probably be proud of my humility. So, you know, what is his tone there? It's you know, there's a kind of levity around the human predicament that humility is a virtue that we would like to have, you know, pride is repugnant, and yet you can't get rid of it. So, how do you have both of these things? And for Franklin, I think the way you have both of them is to find a way to make light of it, or to say this differently. I mean, if you come back to the ownership of knowledge and the cumulativeness of science and so forth, there are always two impulses. One is to put forward the individual genius, and the other is to put forward the collaborative social side of the work. That all of us are simultaneously individualists and social beings. You know, as creators, we are simultaneously originators and borrowers. And, you know, Newton is a giant, and yet he's indebted to giants. And these two sides have ideological shadows as well. You know, there is a culture of individualism which puts the emphasis on the individuality side of this, and there are socialist cultures which put the emphasis on or Republican, civic Republican cultures which push the emphasis on the social side. Or in terms of the ownership of ideas, there, you know, there's the sort of everything should be free side, in which case the whole point is we are a social collaborative, or the Jack Valenti side, in which ownership is the of the idea is the be all and end all. And to my mind, what you see in Franklin is that humor is a way of preserving both of these, of having both without giving up one, as if there's a kind of distortion, an ideological rigidness to coming down on either side of this divide. And when you see how people treat Franklin, you can see that they fall into two camps. Some, I was just reading a book where that claims that Franklin's really about self-negation. His virtue is predicated on his absorption into generality. He repudiates personal authority in favor of general authority based on a negative relation to his own person. But this is true. You can see Franklin not putting himself forward. But then, you know, there's another school of reading Franklin in which he's understood to be a mad egotist. This is John Adams' position. Or to do it in terms of American ideology, this was the way Emerson read Franklin. Emerson, in Self-Reliance, which is the famous 1840s essay about individualism, among the many examples that Emerson gives is Franklin. He says, this is just a quote from Self-Reliance, "Insist on yourself, never imitate. Where is the master who could have instructed Franklin? Every great man is a unique." And my point in talking about Franklin's humor, which is all throughout the work, and it's particularly humor around vanity and pride, that's where you find it. And my point is that both of these readings are nuts, that Franklin manages to figure out how to be simultaneously both things. You know, with his electrical experiments, he's a collaborator and also puts himself forward as the discoverer. And, you know, he uses the we to speak about what they did, but he takes credit for it. Or, you know, in the Constitution, this is my ending point, there is this intellectual property clause has in it this doubleness, which says you're going to give exclusive rights to authors and inventors for limited times. I think that's funny. I think we should have a reading of the Constitution with a laugh track behind it, in which we see that it's kind of civic Republican levity, which manages to honor individualism and sociability without crushing either one of them, and that it's in the Franklin tradition. The wit and wisdom of the Constitution. I see a little pamphlet. And as opposed to Jack Valenti, perpetual copyright, which I don't think is funny at all. That's my second. Can we chew on this at all? What's to say? Questions, thought experiments? How can we translate this into the present moment?
How should we? So, if this is tension that you're reading in Franklin about something like the copyright clause, which has been much argued in the legal space, where it's fared, the sort of collective interpretation has fared almost as badly as it has in the legal space, as in the policy space. What weight should we? Give Franklin, is this something that how do we rate as an originalism argument, which is my maker, or what role should we play?
Right. I mean, this is sort of a qu- more general question for the project I'm doing, because if I'm reading these founding fathers, to what end? And so is it an originalist kind of argument or not? I myself am not an originalist. I don't think... I think the Constitution is a living, breathing... however, I am actually kind of happy to throw a little grit into the originalist machine, because I think if you were real originalists, you would not have been able to read the property, the Progress Clause the way they did in Eldred. I guess for me, the second thing is I am looking for sort of stories and models around which you can explain both why not propertizing knowledge is useful for self-governance and why limits on propertizing it are useful for the creative community. For if you want a generative internet, as Zittrain says, why you limit propertizing. And you can find these any place. I mean, you could take modern science or lots of, but I think it's sort of fun to use to find the stories in that generation as a way of fleshing out these statements. And then I'm not using them as if the fact that they come from this generation is dispositive in the argument. Though to the degree that the founders have any political capital left to spend in American discourse, doesn't hurt to have it from those voices. So in the end, I'm mostly trying to make a good case in the Franklin case, trying to use him to explain why collaborative, unowned knowledge space is better for the generation of new knowledge. And it wouldn't have to be an American founder to make that case.
I guess I'm kind of wondering, if you have, trade secrets, it's understandable that people are keeping stuff secret, that you can't collaborate, that you can't build upon the knowledge other people might have.
Right.
But is ownership really going, like, is it always at odds with collaboration? And if you have something,
right,
but it's still being published and other people can still use it to springboard for their own ideas, no?
Right. Right, and in fact, so one way to understand patent is actually, it was a, others have said this, but the patent, one way of reading the invention of patent was to do exactly this, was to move trade secrets and guild secrecy into the public sphere. And there's a famous case in England where there was an invention called an achromatic telescope lens. It was a way to make a lens that didn't have a problem called color flare. And the lens grinders in London knew how to do this because somebody figured it out decades ago. And then along comes another guy who figures it out independently and patents it. And the lens grinders take him to court and say, you can't have a patent on this because we already know how to do it. And the court judgment is, you can have a patent on it because you did what you're supposed to do, which is to reveal it. You made it available to the public. And so, and that's the trade-off. By putting it in the public domain, you get the short-term monopoly. And so, exactly. But then there is a question about the term of ownership. So the limited monopoly privilege can be seen as a tool for creating a public domain. And I would say for somebody like Franklin, it's again, what I'm trying to say about his humor is that it's a way of having both things at once, and that it's the limited monopoly privilege is likewise a way of honoring both sides of this tension. Yeah.
How do you think these notions of community work in how do they scale? Because it seems like many of these ideas work in very small, confined, if you have an altruistic designer like a Franklin who seemed to enjoy more the discovery part of it than usability later on. And also that he would create it, put it out there, and then let people build on it as they will. But how does that square now with when you get to a certain scale of, like for pharmaceuticals or large technology where you can't have individuals build a certain level? Because it always seems that it's great if you can stand on the shoulder of giants, but after a while, people can't grow that big. After a while, you're going to all be standing on the shoulders of medium-sized dwarves. And so, how do you, because it seems like with technology, it's difficult to really get great advancements after a while if you don't have an influx of capital, an influx of resources, and you need to have some large incentive. It's very hard to get thousands of people with the same goal to just help society.
Yeah. Actually, there's a bunch of questions
in
this, but I mean, one thing I should say is I think Franklin, you could attack Franklin on this in terms of how he made his own living, because he quit business when he was 42, but he had become rich. And he'd become rich as a printer, mostly as a printer. And so he's in a privileged position. That is, he can afford to be the civic republican and give his stuff away. And so the business model behind Franklin is not clear that it could scale or that it can travel into other people's ways of working. I mean, I don't know how to do it with pharmaceuticals. I guess let me just say, you know, to my mind, the question of incentive has not been well expanded, because I guess I'd be willing to have the incentive discussion with the pharmaceutical industry if they would publish their internal bookkeeping. As long as we're not allowed to see how the money works, it's not clear to us what level of incentive they need. And, just to give you a quick associative thing, you know, Benkler's essay, this penguin and the Kosis penguin, it has a sort of expanded sense of what incentives are. And there are lots of different incentives except in addition to the money incentive. And so I think a lot of times the incentive argument doesn't take into account the range of what incentivizes people. And Franklin's incentives, he was actually, I just think, curious. This is what he liked to do. The science particularly was what he liked to do, to relax. Or if you take Newton, I mean, there's other ways to incentivize. Newton had patrons. He had an endowed chair at Cambridge and was patronized by the king. So you can... Or the Human Genome Project was funded by the public purse in the United States and by the Wellcome Trust in England. So if you have target knowledges that you want, there are other ways to incentivize them.
I mean, I've seen with NASA where space travel is basically just a government-run entity because they knew no one else could handle it. I just always kind of was concerned about that scalability.
Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering, isn't there a California-based company, is it Genzyme or Genentech, that started publishing a lot of their stuff? I don't know if anyone knows how that's been working out for them, but I think they started just publishing stuff almost like an academic institution.
I don't know this case, but I mean, there many, many are. I mean, many, many now understand that you know, there's different levels even in the commerce business. That certainly you need a sort of floor of common knowledge upon which you can have commerce. That these are not necessarily at odds. So, or companies that have cross-licensing patents, where you just say, you know, let's all share this knowledge so that we can go on and do something else.
I'm wondering if there's a way to sort of reapproach the lightning rod example in light of Franklin's success as a printer, which is to sort of say, okay, so he's publishing and he's sharing the information, though he is doing it, in fact, in his own journal, which is a moneymaker for him. You know, is he in some ways actually the first to experiment with open source service revenue? I mean, essentially, instead of selling, you know, the hardware in this case, you know, he's selling a subscription model of service instead. I mean, I sort of wonder whether, you know, this isn't the precursor of Red Hat rather than...
That's very good.
Sort of the anyway... I assume that wasn't money making. The Almanac.
Yes, the Almanac made money for Franklin, and that's right. He publishes it in the Almanac. Now I say without copyright, so others could publish it. But
he knew that he had quite a market position at that point.
The other thing to say about the Almanac is it was an early mash tape or mix up or sampling. I mean, it was full of stuff that other people produced, and he just reproduced it. And he would print poems by living poets. He would reprint articles from the Philosophical Investigations from journals in England. The Maxims, you know, he didn't make them up. He got them from elsewhere, and some of them he re phrased, but so it was a grab bag, that public domain grab bag.
So it seems like a lot of this, you can read his position as emanating in some sense from his role as a printer, right? And that's sort of how you started us off, and as a, you know, in publishing. I'm wondering how much you think, I mean, I don't know if you've read about his sort of childhood and the younger stages of his life, or early stages of his life, but how much has the his role in publishing and printing reflect these views versus how much were these views formed by his role? I mean, this is one of these instances where that's what he did early in his life, and that's sort of the lens through which he saw things. And so therefore, the open source model that Ethan's referred to kind of became his way of doing that, and the sort of editing and going for the second edition. Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of a strange question, but I don't know if you have any way of it.
My dad is a huge hero of Franklin. And I think I remember the story right, but he said that he wanted to write for his brother, who was a printer, and his brother told him no. And so he wrote instead and slipped the pieces he wrote under the door anonymously. And after a time there, published, he wanted to know who was writing, but that's how he got his foot in the door. It was not a way to best his brother, but...
Well, it wasn't.
like all things with him.
Yeah, but I'll say a little bit more about this, but to put it in terms of Colin's question, is the question, do the printing trades have this ethic and he begins to learn it from printers, or does he have this ethic and brings it into printing? Or?
And I don't mean so much learn it from printers, from the trades itself, but just from that position in sort of in the economy and society, from his role as printer and publisher, is that sort of the lens through which he sees ideas and common space and so forth? Or is that something that he has from some other previous source? I mean, obviously, he came to printing to his brother, but...
Yeah. You know, it's so early that he becomes a printer that it's hard maybe to make this differentiation that you're suggesting. He's apprenticed, like, at the age of 14 or something, or 12 even. And... the thing I'm thinking about is Boston. At the time, the press in the colonies was a highly controlled press. It was not a free press, and almost all newspapers were published by authority of the crown or the authority of the governor, and often they would have on it published by authority. And Franklin's brother started the third newspaper in Boston. And it was not published by authority. So he's born into a sort of argumentative family that's willing to take on the power structure. And the brother it was a bit of a rabble-rouser, and he got censured by the assembly and threatened with arrest. I think he went into hiding. But this was a time in which the press was controlled to that degree that you could arrest and jail an editor for printing something that was out of favor with the authorities. And and to add to this, the letters that Franklin, the essays that Franklin slips under the door, he assumes a persona. He pretends he's a woman, and he names the woman Silence Duguid. And he writes letters signed Silence Duguid. And there are 14 of these that the brother then prints. And even afterwards, he doesn't know who it is who's published them, because when Franklin stops writing them, the brother at one point advertises, says, does anybody know where Silence Duguid has gone? But one of these letters is published during the time when the brother is jailed, and during the time, or when the brother's in hiding. And during that time, Franklin takes over as the guy running the press. He's like 16 years old. And he runs the press. And the Silence Duguid letter he prints at that time merely reprints a radical Whig essay on the freedom of the press from England. There were these things called Cato's letters, which were radical Whig iterations about liberty. And at that point, he's 16, he's still in Boston, but he's part of a growing ethic of the press should not have to answer to the authorities for as to what it's printing.
He would have been a blogger.
So he would have been, you think? Yeah. He was a blogger. There is, by the way, just up in the last 6 months, a website. The Yale University Press has been producing volumes of all of Franklin's writings. They're up to like volume 32 now or something. But they began to digitize the writings, and they've now put up a site. The Packard Humanities Institute has put this up. And so essentially all of Franklin's writings are available on the web as a searchable database. And that's how I've been able to put in the words copy and write, boom, and see, and the word patent, and
Nothing comes up for blog out there. I wonder if you can say a little bit more about sort of dissemination of scholarly knowledge at this point in time. What's the time flow of something coming from Europe and coming back? And also, what are the sort of ownership issues in this? To what extent are we dealing with former journals? To what extent are we still very much within the sphere of letters? How is Franklin discovering the discoveries that are going on with his contemporaries in Europe? And how radically different is what he does with the lightning rod or his electricity experiments as far as the dissemination of that information?
Okay, some of it is by letters, but there is there are both journals and books available, and Franklin's learning, he's an incredibly bookish man. And to take two examples, the Franklin stove and the lightning rod, in both cases, He's read Newton's Optics, and he's read all the popular redescriptions of what Newton did, which are available as books from the continent. He's read the journals are not exactly scientific. They're sort of, you know, maybe philosophical inquiries, and one in France are bona fide scientific journals, but there are sort of popular science things, like a thing called the Gentleman's Quarterly, which will publish easier to read descriptions of scientific innovations, and these circulate, I think, within a matter of 6 months at most. So there is a time lag, but it's not tremendous. And the centers are Paris, London, and all this stuff comes back to the New World. And these guys all read each other. So the people in Paris are reading. Franklin's electrical experiments make suggestions about experiments to conduct. And they get published in England. They're almost immediately translated into French. In France, people do an experiment that Franklin suggested before Franklin himself does it. And the results then are published in France and then translated in English, and they come back to America, and he reads about it here. And the Franklin stove, two facts about the Franklin stove. People say my childhood understanding was the innovation was to make a freestanding stove that heated the room because it stood out like a fireplace. This is not true. There were several kinds of freestanding stoves in the colonies at the time. The innovation had to do with the air circulation, and it was a way of getting the hot air to go up and then down and then up the chimney so that you would not lose all the heat as it moved around, and also a way of getting air to come in that was used for combustion that went up the chimney. The sad fact is actually the Franklin stove didn't work very well. There is only one extant version Franklin stove left in existence, and it's been modified to make it work better. but
second edition.
It's a second edition, exactly.
And the innovation was this, what Franklin calls a siphon in reverse. That is to say, a water siphon, you make water go uphill and then downhill. And Franklin's stove made air go downhill and then up. The old understanding since ancient times had been that hot air rises. And so it was an innovation that comes out of Boyle and other English scientists that you about how thermodynamics, about how you can make hot air go down under certain situations. And so Franklin designs the stove this way. And he also has read a book from France about how to design stoves. So he's deep into a network of print publications that are both books, public scientific journals. I don't think he... You know, the way his stuff gets published is he writes it as a letter to people in England, but it's sort of clear that what he wants them to do is to read it before the Royal Society. And they do, and when it's read, then it gets turned into a pamphlet and printed. So it, in a way, he's offering it up as a thing to be published. Does this answer your question?
It helps a lot, yes.
For Franklin, though, publication was of interest always. And to the degree that letters were used to keep things secret, that's not Franklin's style. It might have been Newton's style, but it was not Franklin's style.
So when he's sending letters, he's sending multiple copies of letters?
Now, that I don't know, but he's not against their being published. And most of what, you know, when his invention of the stove, he immediately publishes it as a pamphlet. So it's disseminated not in a letter, it's disseminated as a pamphlet. I'll give you the other example of cumulative scientific information. Franklin is credited with describing the Gulf Stream and the circulation of water in the streams in the Atlantic. And the way he comes to it is people notice that boats making transatlantic journeys show up at different times, whereas it seems to be equidistant. And also boats coming from Europe to the States docking at different ports, where it seems to be more or less equidistant journeys, have significantly different times. And so they don't know what this is. Is it winds? Is it the way the boat's made or whatever? And he gets into a discussion in London with a guy who's a whaler out in Nantucket. So it's a sea captain who does whaling. And the sea captain knows about the Gulf Stream. And how does he know this? Because it turns out that whales do not feed in the Gulf Stream. They feed at the edges of it. And so if you're a whaler, you begin to know, if you're trying to figure out where the whales are, this is a piece of craft knowledge that you want to have, that you're in or out of the Gulf Stream. And you can tell when you're in or out by the temperature of the water. And and Franklin says to this guy, can you mark these streams on a map? And he gives him a map of the North Atlantic, and the captain marks the Gulf Streams, and Franklin immediately publishes the map. Now, you know, it's a wonderful example of cumulative knowledge. Who knows this? Whales. If you're looking for priority, it's the whales who are the first people to know about the Gulf Stream. Whales communicated to sea captains, and sea captains to Franklin, and Franklin to the public. So he's credited with doing it, and he then goes on, you know, on his transatlantic journeys to pass the time of day. He keeps taking measurements of the water temperature. So he does make a contribution in terms of exactitude. But again, there's craft knowledge, community of knowledge that Franklin gets into and, you know, makes a contribution and then publishes. Well,
I think perhaps on the note of having involved whales, rabbis, and a variety of other characters in your tales, that we should offer you our thanks for these stories of Franklin and how he might, his thinking might be relevant to the questions we're asking today. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much.